All right, so this morning we're going to look at Genesis 3. We finally got there. And we'll continue to look at the covenant of works. We looked at its establishment last week, that the covenant was established between God and Adam. Adam would represent mankind. God created mankind, and now the test if they wanted to live in obedience to him under his authority, or they wanted to be gods themselves. And so Adam represented all mankind, and he chose very freely to disobey God and not to have God rule over him. And at that point, all mankind fell because he represented them. But before we get to the actual fall, we're going to look at the temptation in the covenant of works that started the process. So Genesis 3, 1 through 5. Now the serpent was craftier than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden?" The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say you shall not eat fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it or you will die." You will certainly not die," the serpent said to the woman, "for God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." Now, we're very used to this story, of course, but what should surprise us is the presence of Satan. That's what's so unexpected, because we just saw that God had made everything and declared everything good. We have a garden like paradise, everything God made, and God did create Satan too. And yet here in the midst of where everything's supposed to be good, Satan is. So that's what's unusual, sort of comes out of nowhere. According to the Bible, Satan is a fallen angel. And one of the places we see that is Revelation 12. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And so Satan was created, but he was created good before he fell. He was one of the angels, and when he fell, he brought many others with angels with him that became demons. And so it raises the question, if Satan is already evil in the garden, why did God call everything in the world good? Remember, in that word was even used, everything is good. The answer I would suggest to you is that he fell in the garden. That the reason he could deceive Eve is that he was good at one time that Adam and Eve even knew. And I'll show you that. Now he appears as a serpent. The word is nachash, which in the Hebrew is interesting. Because actually, remember, the Hebrew Bible only had consonants. And the vowels were added later. If you take those consonants and you see how that word is used, there's actually three uses if you just add different vowels. One is serpent. The other is deceiver, and the third is shining one. It's used throughout the Old Testament when something looks like shining brass. So Michael Heiser, who's done a lot of work on Genesis, suggests that it's actually all three. That we have a serpent, and we're not talking about a snake on the ground, but a winged serpent, who was also a deceiver, but also shone with brightness. And it's interesting that ancient depictions of seraphim are angels, depicted them as winged serpents. So we think of serpents and we have very bad connotations. But originally, serpents weren't considered evil. They were pictures of angels. And so what I'm suggesting to you, and I'm going to show this now as we look at Ezekiel 28, is that Satan was created and he was one of the guardian angels in the garden. And then he fell, he rebelled against God in the garden. We don't know how long Adam and Eve are in the garden. It could have been years. We're simply not told. But in Ezekiel 38, excuse me, 28, the king of Tyre is being judged. But as the king of Tyre is being judged, the language goes beyond him to who's behind him, to Satan. And so there's sort of a double judgment here. There's a picture of Satan behind the king. Because this description in one way fits the king, but ultimately could only fit Satan. And so it says, "Son of man, take up a lament concerning the king of Tyre and say to him, this is what the sovereign Lord says. You were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and beauty, and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone adorned you. Your settings and mountings were made of gold. On the day you were created, you were prepared. You were anointed as a guardian cherub, so I ordained you. You were on the holy mount of God. You walked among the fiery stones. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created till wickedness was found in you. Through your widespread trade, you were filled with violence and you sinned. So I drove you in disgrace from the mount of God, and I expelled you, guardian cherub, from among the fiery stones." So notice how he mentions Eden. Obviously, the king of Tyre was never in the Garden of Eden. And the shininess. You're made of gold. Every precious stone adorn you. Those are pictures of shining. And then it's there that he fell. It's there that he sinned and rebelled against God. And so, it is possible that Satan was a guardian angel, a seraph or a cherub, in Eden in the form of a shining serpent. And that's why Eve would assume that she could speak to him. Because at first it's very odd that why would she just start talking to an animal? The animals couldn't talk. And so wouldn't she be really flabbergasted, astonished, afraid, if one of the animals that never talked all of a sudden just started talking? But the conversation just seems, he speaks and she responds. So what I'm suggesting to you, that the normal picture is that Satan was in heaven and then sinned in heaven and then as a punishment was cast down to the earth. And then he found his way into the garden, and then there he tempted Adam and Eve. But I'm suggesting to you the biblical picture is he was in Eden as a guardian angel, and that's when he fell. And so Eve would have not thought she was talking to a normal animal, but talking to an angel. And she would have seen this guardian angel before in the garden. Now, am I speculating? Yes, I'm not going to die on this hill. But I think it does explain Genesis 3 much better. Why? It explains why God could call everything he made good on the earth, because it was still good when he made it. Satan was still good. He hadn't fallen yet and become Satan. And it also explains the naturalness with Eve is speaking to this creature. So any thoughts on that? That may be somewhat new to you, but does it kind of help the picture at all? I have heard that he does represent Adam, but I go with Satan. I think it's a little more towards Satan. But it, you know, Adam fell in the garden also. But Adam didn't shine. He wasn't a cherub. It was never called a cherub. Here he's called a cherub. So I think behind the king of Tyre is Satan here. Yeah. Yes? I mean, we'll talk about that next week, but it's probably symbolic, and that's usually the way that term was used. On your belly is a defeat phrase. It's not a changing in an animal's nature. It's not it, right? And so his fall to the earth is described in Genesis 3. It's not two falls. if you think it's twofold, and you have him falling from heaven, and then in Genesis 3, God's saying, to the dust you shall go. I'm suggesting when God says, to the dust you shall go, that is his fall. That's his punishment. And so it's all talking of the same event, the fall of Satan, not two falls, but one. Yeah, Milton could be wrong, yes. Still worth reading, but that's Paradise Lost, the poem, by the way. He's talking about, yes.
Yeah, just plain English.
No, he would have both as an angel, yes. But he, because remember, angels can go from heaven to earth in the Bible. We see that, ministering angels. Pardon? Well, I think they could, at least in the Old Testament, yeah. So the point, the casting down to earth is not the planet earth, it's the ground, is the point. So we when we see earth, we think planet. But here it's to the dust, it's symbolic of his judgment. Any other thoughts on that or questions? And I think it helps also because there is a growing tendency to take all this as a myth. Because it reads almost like a myth where, how is Eve just talking to animals? And why does she think that's normal? You've been around animals for a while now. It almost reads that. And so, you know, those who are starting to deny the historicity of all this are saying, this is really all mythological. But I think it helps, you see, if this is an angel, it would make complete sense why Eve would be deceived by him, for one, because, you know, up till now, he has been speaking good. So it makes the deception even make more sense, too. It's what? It's a greater betrayal, yeah. And you would expect in God's presence to have guardian angels. We see that throughout the Bible. So it wouldn't be surprising that there's a guardian angel in Eden near God's presence. And he would be expected to be, yes, guardian, yes. Yeah, I haven't thought of that connection. But when Paul says in Galatians 1, if an angel from heaven should preach another gospel, and here an angel from heaven is teaching something wrong, right? So let's look then at the temptation. The first one part is really more food for thought. Hopefully that can open up the passage a bit. But Satan goes after Adam through Eve. Satan knows he has to convince Adam because Adam is the federal head. He's the one that can break the covenant with God. But he doesn't do it directly, he does it indirectly, he goes through Eve. Now some have brought from this that Eve must have been gullible. There are many problems with that. First of all, if God created people gullible, then you've got a problem with creation itself being all good. But it really doesn't make sense because what's the difference? Adam was not gullible. Adam knew what he was doing. So whether an angel or a wife tempted him or wouldn't matter. You know, you'd still have the same decision to make. It would be exactly the same. Matter of fact, you would think the angel would be more persuasive than his wife. And so it's not that she was gullible, and there's no way for Satan to know if she was gullible. What is he watching that says, ah, she's very gullible? So that's not the point at all. The point is that he takes the indirect approach. And we'll see that's usually how Satan works. Now, Satan's question, what did God say to you? Did he actually say? In a sense, you can see why she was deceived because she's assuming he's just asking for information. He wasn't necessarily there, or if he was, you know, but he's... From her perspective, he's asking information. What did God actually say to you? Did he actually tell you this? He's asking in a to trick her, to just give her information, to see what she would say. He's going to draw out from her what she's thinking. And so it'd come off innocent, and the you is plural in the Hebrew. So what did God tell you both? What did he tell you about these trees? Did he say you couldn't eat from any of these trees? Question. Now, Eve's answer is very famous, isn't it? Because she says, we may eat from the trees in the garden, but God did say you must not eat fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it or you will die. So the phrase, obviously, that stands out is the addition, you shall not touch it. Now, what do we do with that? There are two views. The first one is probably the most popular one today, is that Eve was the first Pharisee. She was the first legalist. She added to the word of God. Because if you go back in Genesis 2, the Lord doesn't say you should not touch the fruit. He says you should not eat of the fruit of the tree. And so she added a law. And so here you have sort of the foundation of legalism by adding a law. The next view, and it's one that I'm gonna suggest, is that touching simply assumes eating. And that's just very common, even in the Old Testament. So it's possible Adam added that simply for precaution. Stay away from that fruit. Don't touch it or eat it. Why else would you pick a fruit down and touch it if you were planning on eating it? So it's sort of a given. And it's even possible that what we have is even short for maybe what God actually said longer, which is very common too. But notice in Genesis 3:22, once they fall and they're not supposed to eat of the tree of life, from that point, it says, lest he reach out his hand. So even here it's saying, lest he reach out and touch it. And then the assumption would be, and then eat it. So I doubt if she's the first Pharisee here. I doubt if she's actually adding. It's more likely she's summarizing what was said. Stay away from that fruit. Don't pick it and eat it. Now, it makes a great sermon, right? But it's probably really looking way too much past the point. Well, let's stop there on C. Any comments or questions on that? Yes. Yeah, we'll get to that right down here. No, that's next week. I'm sorry. I know it was in my notes, but it's next Sunday. We'll look at that. Yeah, no spoilers a week before. But how many of you had heard sermons on Eve as the first legalist here? It's pretty common, right?
It's funny.
Oh, yeah, the most legalistic people. Like, and it really takes away from the idea that she was deceived. She would already be in sin here, even before she eats, which is not really the picture. What causes her to sin is looking at the fruit and deciding to take it against God's command. Not that she's already a legalist before that. Yes. That was the first sin, was the legalism. Yeah. That's really taking way too much from this. Some things just preach so well because it's so easy, but it may not be accurate. All right, any other thoughts on the temptation? All right, Satan's response to what Eve said starts with a lie. You shall not die. Now remember, the death that's being predicted here is spiritual death. Because what does the New Testament say? We are dead in sin, right? Ephesians 2, when we were dead. So the death, because if people have said that God changed his mind. On the day you shall eat of it, you shall die. They eat of it, and do they die? Well, they don't physically die, but do they die? Yes. So it does happen according to what God said. He doesn't describe the exact kind of death here. But we learn later on they spiritually were dead, and that would lead then at that point to their physical death. But God didn't change his mind. God didn't say, on the day you eat of it, you shall die. Okay, I have a better idea. I'll let you live. That didn't happen. They died, exactly as God said. But of course, Satan is challenging that. So the first one is a challenge. You won't really die. Now that raises the question, why then would God lie? And so this whole temptation is what is suggesting that God's motives for the covenant of works were suspect. God's motives. Why doesn't he want you to eat the fruit? We would assume God's motives are good. He wants Adam to get to heaven with all people, but they have to choose to want to be in heaven. They want to be obedient. But Satan is now causing Eve to question God's motives. Why did he really forbid that one fruit? What is he afraid of? Is the idea. And so the answer, what he's suggesting is that he knows that when you eat of it, you're going to be just like him. And he doesn't want the rivalry. He doesn't want you to have that much power. And so he's holding you back, right? Isn't that the number one criticism of religion? It holds you back, Christianity. You can't do what you want to do. So he's going to hold you back, because if you eat of that magic fruit, that fruit has so much power that you're going to be able to become just like him. And didn't God say you'd become like him in one sense, right? So there's some truth to it, but it's like Satan does, he takes a little truth and then he mixes it with so much lie. And so God doesn't want them to eat the fruit because they would know good and evil in an experimental way. It'll hurt them. So God is trying to protect them. And what Satan is suggesting is God is really protecting himself from rivals. And he knows you will be a rival. You will be like God. Now think about how much power you have to want when God has created you and told you you have dominion over this world. And then they want more. They want complete control. They want to be just like God. And so that's the temptation to Eve, to be like God. And of course, what happens when she looks at the fruit and it looks good to her, and she knows it'll make her wise, she takes it. And so the first sin was Eve, right, in taking of the fruit. She sins before Adam sins. Now that raises the question in number one. If Eve sinned first, why did sin and death come through Adam? Yeah, and that's Klein teaches that not only should have Adam rebuke Satan, but then he should have rebuked Eve. Because to protect the garden would be, now both of you have profaned God's sanctuary, both of you. And Klein actually teaches that God would have given him another wife if he had done that, which is, it's speculating. But why else, if Eve sinned first, why does the fall come through Adam? Because Adam is the chosen representative of mankind in the covenant of works. And so through Adam, sin came into the world as a legal judgment on all mankind because of that representative nature. So that's why it's so important to see that idea of federal headship, of representation. Adam was the representative. Any thoughts on number one? Yeah, it's hard to know. That's a good question. They knew what death was because they would see animals being dying. They knew what physical death was.
So when they ate,
No, because I think they got it because they were redeemed after that. So they understood that they were dead and was brought back to life. Other thoughts? Well, the second question, we're introduced to Satan here, and right away we see the way he operates. the way he went to try to bring mankind from God. And he succeeded. So what do we learn about Satan's schemes from Genesis 3? There's a number of lessons here of how he normally likes to operate. What are some things we learn? Say it again. Yeah, and kind of follow up, what do you mean? Yeah, it comes at you indirectly, right? I mean, most of you are not going to be tempted by Mormonism. You just won't. You're too smart for that. You see the differences. But does that mean you won't be tempted by false doctrine at all? It'll just be more subtle, right? It'll be from within the church, not from something like Mormonism, indirectly. What's another indirect way? Partial truth.
Half-truth is the best lie.
The what?
Half-truth is
the half-truth, best. Yeah. Yeah, it frames it in such a way that it doesn't sound so bad. I mean, most of you will not be tempted, let's say, by outright sexual temptation. That's obvious, but there are indirect ways to tempt you. Or you won't be tempted by spending all your money on video games, but you may be tempted in trusting in your riches. In, you know, more subtle. Things that aren't bad in themselves, but can become an idol. Those are more tempting than obvious idols, right? So we see that Satan uses indirect approaches as he did with Adam. Maybe if Eve, his wife, who he just said, you are my bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Maybe if she came to him, that may do better than me going direct at this point. The indirect approach. And so how are we warned about that in the New Testament? Yeah, he appears as an angel of light, 2 Corinthians. He appears from within Christianity, not usually from without. He appears in the guise of, this is what God wants to, if you believe this, you know, or if you want something. So we're always being warned to be careful of his schemes because the obvious ones we get. Right? Yes. Yeah, especially when you look at the king of Tyre, who thought of himself as a god. So the nations all had kings who thought of themselves as gods. And here, that is directly from Satan, to think you can be as a god, right?
Also makes 1 Samuel quite problematic.
Which part?
When they ask for a king like other nations.
Yeah, when they want a king like other nations in Samuel, you see the problem. So you actually can learn a lot about things just from these short verses as they're expanded upon throughout the rest of the Bible. Any other thoughts on the temptation? So next week we'll look at the actual fall then with Adam, with Eve taking and then giving to Adam. And then what's going on when they're hiding in the garden? This is where probably the most obvious translation problem comes. Is what it says when it says, and God was walking in the cool of the day. That's probably the worst translation in the Old Testament almost. So we'll look at the Hebrew on that. And because that doesn't make a lot of sense. But we'll save that for next week. Any other thoughts on this morning? Yeah. Yeah. Right. He didn't use that term in class a lot, but the idea, yeah, it was they wanted to be in charge. They didn't want anyone over them. They wanted to be like God in every way. They have that power, authority. Yeah. I mean, isn't that still the greatest temptation is when there's something you really want, and I'm not talking about evil things, just things you want in life, and you don't have them, that you question God's motives? Does he really love me? So it's the same temptation, the same thought that Satan was saying to Eve. Does he really have your best interest at heart? If he did, wouldn't he give you this? So we're always, but that temptation is always there for a Christian, isn't it? Any other final thoughts? You can close out the morning with your brilliance right now. No pressure. All right, let's go ahead and pray.